Okay, well, welcome back, and everyone, there'll be people joining us as we go on. But I do want to get into this, and I always preface these calls while we're waiting for people to join that we work as a mentoring organization, and of course, next August, we're going to be having an all-grantee meeting, and anyone that comes to the PLCs will be invited to that. This is the 10th of the 10th call. We're going to have a special call on January 6th, and that's just a few days before the grant is due on the 14th, and that'll be kind of a tune-up call to just let everyone know last-minute checks in terms of their grant and their grant submission. While we basically are involved in helping and mentoring communities to see if they want to get a program started and existing grantees to try to improve their program, mostly by sharing information with each other. Because we're so near to the due date of the request for proposals, the last several calls, we've gone over several aspects of job training. Last PLC call we did recruitment. Today we're going to be talking about student retention and also talking about some of the aspects of this grant proposal that have been confusing to certain people. So in just a second we'll get started on this. Can you hear me all right? Okay, someone just joined?
Yes, Anita from Detroit.
Okay, great. Well, welcome back. We're going to get started, and there might be some people joining us. As I said, today we want to talk about a fairly, as I had indicated, a kind of a serious issue that came up. This is the first time when Office of General Counsel wanted the EPA evaluators to more align the courses with the funding that's available, and it did cause a bunch of confusion for people. And I'm going to talk about that. I might wait for a few more people to come online because it's been a confusing issue. But I think we've got a resolution. Did you all get the reminder and the letter that Joe sent out about this issue that kind of clarifies the funding of the different courses? I don't know if you did.
I did not receive an email.
Oh, you didn't. Okay. I'll make sure I put it in the post-session notes to everybody. And it does clarify this issue a little bit. You know, what I think I might do is, before I talk about this, because we'll be having other people join us, I want to talk a little bit about retention first. We normally would go through this issue and then go into retention. But I think we're going to have some people joining us, and I'd hate to have them miss this this particular point about funding. The one thing about student retention, which we wanted to talk about today, was it weighs heavily on how they evaluate these grants. And it's one thing, and last week we talked about recruiting your students. Retention and placement really goes hand in hand with student recruitment. If you recruit a really good class, they're more likely to stick with you, and they'll also be a lot easier to place. But what we found with most of our grants that are work really well is that student retention is highly dependent on team building. The obvious thing is to link up with the WIB. And, of course, we suggest that all of our grantees connect with the Workforce Investment Board, that they can provide all sorts of leverage services, things like daycare, transportation, books, safety equipment. Now, this does depend on your local WIB, but it's really important that you touch base with them. And, of course, in the case of Missouri, for example, you are the WIB, the Workforce Development Board, linking with the city. But it's just so important to contact them and see if They can help your students with leverage services. And for those of you who are just joining, we're going to talk about this issue of funding of different projects in a second, but we thought we would talk about retention first until, because there'll be more people joining the call. What the WIB can provide is all sorts of things, transportation, daycare, all sorts of things. And of course, Christine, I don't know if she's on the line yet, but they do it. They're probably one of the best examples of how the WIB partners with the trainers out in Tacoma, and they screen everyone. They make sure that everyone who's qualified in the program to receive benefits get benefits. So the WIB is extremely important. You may have a WIB, Workforce Investment Board, that isn't quite as active, and some that are very active. As we've talked about in previous calls, the Workforce Investment Board can also provide you with a stream of students, but you have to be careful. When they do, you have to also do your own screening, final acceptance. And those basically are interviews, personal, to determine whether they're good in terms of working in teams, to giving you as your organizational final say to make sure it would be a good fit. But they really are excellent in terms of getting people into your program, doing some initial assessments, the TABE or CASA tests. They also can be very helpful often in placement once people are trained. But the main thing we like in terms of the retention ability to help you is providing other benefits to your students. While that's really important, we found that if you want to keep your students together, you've got to build teams. And we find that when people want to come to class and they've built up a support network and they built up friendships and a team building, they'll come to class. And if they feel alienated and they're not part of the group, there's less of a tendency to stay together. And our best programs are programs where the graduates of these programs become, they develop these friendships and they last way beyond the placement. When the program's finished, they'll go to work. They may even switch jobs to go work with their buddies. So team building in terms of retention is extremely important. And the question is what strategies can you use to get this interaction or this team building together? And you want to do certain activities. Some of our organizations, for example, Oregon Tradeswomen, they do night outs, which is outside of the realm of the training itself, where they get together might be some restaurant or tavern or club, and they just socialize together, and it builds the support, and the people, again, will, as I said, they'll want to come to class because their friends are there. When they graduate, they're going to keep in touch. And of course, as we develop these programs, we usually keep everyone in touch with emails and different social media. That's a whole other thing we'll talk about it in future sessions, but it's all part of that team building approach. Another thing that's really important in terms of retention and keeping students together is this mentoring of experienced people, graduates and staff, with your students. And ideally, if you could develop peer-to-peer mentoring for some of the students who might be a little more knowledgeable, a little more experienced, a little older, can work with some of your students who have less experience and might be struggling. And that peer-to-peer mentoring is so important. Not only the peer-to-peer mentoring, but also staff members who work as mentors for their students. We like to make sure that every student in your program is watched over by somebody, perhaps as an advocate. If you've got several staff, informally get together and say, make sure you look after these certain students. For classes are small. It could be 20 people, and they're certainly manageable. So you can assign different advocates to different students, and when you see they're struggling, or they need some help, or they've got some personal problems, you get involved. I think one of our exemplary grantees is Art Shanks, who really intervenes to the extent where if he has someone who is in trouble. In fact, he talks about it at the annual grantee meeting, that he knows the judge. He goes to court, and if there's an issue and one of his students has a ticket or some kind of issue, he'll go to the judge and he talks to them and says, he's a serious student, he's enrolled, he's a good kid, and I'm going to vote for him. So he's really involved with this. And of course, many of our grantees, they start developing these relationships in the interview process. The WIB will, the One Stop or the John Franklin Career Center may set over many students, and through your process of recruitment, as we talked about last time, to narrow it down, your final interview steps will be talking to students the one-on-one on a personal basis. Some he's even getting to know the families, and might be a family problem. You can certainly tell any students, particularly in smaller groups, if someone's having a real issue, and you've got to treat it that way. These grants are different than your normal classroom where students come in, they get the instruction, they go up. When I was in school, it was a large state school in engineering, the professor would come in, work on overhead projector, walk out with no interaction with the students. So this is a total opposite of that. The teacher is really going to get...
I don't know if anyone else is having trouble hearing you, but it might be on my end, but I can hardly hear you.
Okay, I'll talk louder.
Oh, there's a lot of static.
Yeah,
static
and warbling.
We're having some tremendous problems with the, and it's interesting, as I said earlier, we've had 140 calls, and I think almost all but one has been flawless. But this one seems to be having a lot of problems with this. I'll talk as loud as I can. And
the volume is fine, Mike. It's the static. Your words are like gobbled up.
Really? They've been having a lot of problems with this this conference call program today. I'll try to talk a little slower, and I'm also going to put all of these things in the section notes, so hopefully that will help also. What I'm trying to get across on retention is not only contacting WIB and making sure every one of your students gets all the benefits they can, they qualify, but the second thing to do is to get that interaction and team building among your students. And you're going to find if you do that.
Excuse me, Mike. Since there's only like five or eight of us, why don't I give them my EPA conference line number, and then they can all call in on that.
Okay.
And then you won't have to worry about the static and noise and stuff. Okay, hold on. I'm going to call. I'll give it to you right now. Hold on. As soon as I remember what I did. Okay, hold on. Nope, that wasn't it. Contacts. Okay. All right. Okay, is reservationless conference 1-866-299-3188.
Now, we just call this number. And we'll be okay.
You call that number, and then you put in this code, 404-562-8660.
Okay, why don't we repeat this? So we're going to call 866-299-3188, and then they're going to ask for a code, and it'll be 404-562-8660.
Yes, but don't hang up from you all. Let me call first to make sure.
Okay, I'll continue.
My leader's password.
Okay, I'm going to continue this. I'm going to continue this call until we hear from you.
Okay, great.
This is kind of like a screening process. We're making it really difficult for everyone, and I apologize for that. So basically,
now it doesn't sound like we have a problem. We're hearing you just fine.
Great. Okay.
Yeah, I can hear you just fine now, too.
I wonder if it's something that we're having problems with Kathleen and being on that line.
I don't know.
No, okay. I'm still on the line. Ha, ha, yeah. So don't say anything else about me.
Yeah, it's coming through the
phone.
Yeah,
well, everything's fine.
Through much better now.
Okay. Well, I was giving you all these compliments on the first call. Now I'm saying it's all your fault. Okay.
That's okay. It evens out.
Well, let's continue. As I said on recruitment, I'm going to jump over now to what I think is really important in this call, and it was this whole issue of how do we align our training with the EPA funding and how they can do it. And after our call last time and the webinars, it became very confusing. And Joe wrote a letter to us. We wrote a letter to Joe and say, Joe, could you clarify? He wrote a letter back. And it was a really good response, and I've sent that out. I'm going to send it in the post-session notes. I also sent it in the invites to this PLC it wasn't an email, but it was basically in quotations what he said. And basically what it appears to me is happening is they have to align these. Most of the money is $3.36 million is coming out of hazardous waste. They have to try to link as much of that to brownfields as they can. And then, of course, they've got the other $150,000 from other organizations. But Joe, in that email, said that we're going to include lead abatement, we're going to include asbestos abatement, RRMP, which is renovation repair, confined space, forklift operator, heavy machinery operations, of course, hazmat, the HazWhopper 40-hour, CDL, OSHA, and even stormwater management. We're going to consider those as brownfield hazardous waste training, which is really counterintuitive to what we all thought early on. But he said we feel that we could convince the people that are involved that these are all mandatory and necessary to clean up the brownfields. And he's correct. We did question him earlier that, you know, things like forklift operator, confined space, they are all part of brownfields. There are brownfields hazardous waste abatement waste sites that have asbestos and they have lead. And certainly there's things like OSHA health and safety that if you're going to go on site, you have to have these things. If you're working in a brownfield that's got lead paint, you're going to need that. You might need the renovation repair. So the conclusion that I believe they came to, and of course, and Kathleen's aware of this, he sent an email out to all the regional coordinators clarifying that. And I assume that when the evaluators get together, they'll probably repeat that and talk about it. I, and being on the outside, I'm not privy to what grantee applicants should do, but I think if I were writing an application, I would still link it to the importance of these courses that you propose to brownfields hazardous waste, just to make sure. In other words, if you're proposing certain courses like asbestos abatement or RRMP, just put in some sort of sentence that this is, you consider this is important in cleaning up your brownfields. It will give Joe or the evaluators or maybe someone who's looking at this program to find something that's not right with it that, yes, there is a link between the training you're proposing and brownfields, and that links to the $3.36 million that they're funding. I think that there's always people who are scrutinizing these programs, and you want to you don't want a situation where someone comes along and says, well, you're funding these training and they have nothing to do with brownfields. And I understand and agree what EPA is trying to do here in terms of we don't want to lie ourselves open to criticism that we're funding something else with Brownfield's money, and that's fair and understandable. So all of those things in the email, and I'll put it in the post-session notes, those courses, according to Joe's email, are fair game and can be funded under Brownfield Hazardous Waste under that $3.363 million pot. But again, as a safety measure, what I would do is I would still link those courses, just a few words, to Brownfield somehow, just to make sure and to cover yourself. Now, there's other courses that are kind of iffy. Are they Brownfields or are they chemical safety? That was enhanced environmental health and safety was one of those. They contributed $10,000 to this program. Obviously, if you say this is a chemical safety course, you might be, and you can't link it to Brownfields, it's going to fall into this $10,000 category. Solid waste management cleanup is the same way. If you're going to be doing something in solid waste, something like reclamation or recycling, you really would, you have to understand it's going to fall into that $10,000 that they have allocated. Superfund is the same way. Superfund Innovation Alternative Treatments. If you're doing something in that, they contributed $25,000. Again, if you can't link it to the cleanup of a brownfield, I would be aware that it will be subject to those smaller funding limitations. Wastewater is the big one. They contributed $47,000. Now, that's a lot of money. We've got a couple of grantees already doing wastewater treatment programs, and they're doing a good job. This is going to be a little tricky in future years if they or when they re-up. $47,000 among 17 applicants doesn't go very far. So the evaluators are going to have to say, do we fund one course that's really good? Say, example, we have a program that's out there that's doing a great job in this, and they're everything points to a great program. They may decide to fund that program, which might leave very little for anyone else. The same goes with emergency planning and response or alternative energy, which is the preparation of contaminated sites. There's a big movement on to take sites that are contaminated and turn them into solar farms and that type of thing. Now, if you were to do something like that and link it to Brownfield's hazardous waste, that would be one thing where it might go into that other pot. But if it doesn't, it's going to be subject to that $15,000. So there's, again, if it were me, I would be very careful. And, of course, awareness courses are encouraged. And once you train your students, they're going to be placed. Nobody's saying that they have to be placed in that. They're going to be placed in all sorts of environmental jobs. The awareness is a good thing to have because while someone may be interviewing a brownfield community, they might say, well, we're working in brownfields, but what do you know about wastewater or what do you know about pest management or one of these others? So a few years ago, they included the awareness training, and that's something to consider. But if you do it, be aware that it could be pulled out of your grant, but it's not that it's a good thing. And the other thing to be aware of is they do have to spend this money. And the question that will come up next year will be from these programs, how are you using my money? And we certainly wouldn't want everyone to be training in brownfields hazardous waste and nobody training in wastewater or nobody doing pest management awareness or something, because then they would probably have to go back and say, well, we're not doing any training with the money you gave us, and that's almost as bad. So we're kind of on uncharted territory right now, but we want everyone to be aware so that there isn't confusion. I think that the email that Joe sent was a really well-crafted one, and that we kind of are all on the same page in terms of those courses that they feel they could fund with the $3.3 million. But again, as I said, you probably should link it to Brownfields. Kathleen, do you have anything to add to that, what I just said?
Basically, as I said, it's only $140,000. So I would say do not depend on any major part of your program on those components that were mentioned. They're approved. So if you want to do a couple of awareness classes, in case you don't make, in case you do make it and you want to have an introduction to it and have some way where they can, where the trainees can segue into actual certification for those classes through a partner or something, that's fine. But it's too little money, and that's not going to go very far. And as Joe said during the webinar, the $140,000 is going to go to the top scores. The top scores are going to have a comprehensive, well-rounded program. The more comprehensive your program is, the better the chances for long-term employment, which is ultimately the goal. Back to you, Mike.
Okay. Excuse me?
No, I was just saying that's
the way, that's what you would say is focus on that, on those first set of courses and then take the other under advisement and go with that.
Make the core classes, the brownfield program assessment, emergency response, not assessment, sampling and analysis, emergency response, those things that are going to tie in with cleanup of brownfield sites.
Right. And then
other classes would be ancillary, as I said, perhaps on the awareness level rather than concentrating more extensively in what it will take to get it certified, unless,
right,
of course, you have partners,
right,
training,
right,
partners.
And clearly, to the extent that you could leverage anything, is what you want to do. Well, I'm going to jump back to the major part of the other part of this discussion today. We talked about retention of your students, and of course, the other part of this is placement of your graduates. And there's going to be a site that I'm going to put on the post-session notes that I recommend you check. It's put out by the Environmental Law Institute. It's called the Brownfield Center. I really like this site. It has nothing to do with the government or any government organizations. It's called a Brownfield Center, and it's a little tool that allows you to go into any state. I like going into the region and then picking out developers. You could pick out developers, nonprofits, businesses, and they'll give you contact information. And you can go in, for example, if I went into North Carolina where I live, and businesses, they didn't have any businesses, but when I went to the regional scan, it gave me all sorts of employers of environmental contractors. I could go to nonprofits or I could go to governmental agencies, and it would also give me contact information of those. You might check it out in your region and see. But, you know, part of the placement is going to happen by itself. Early on in earlier calls, we talked about building partnerships, and you're going to need to do this for your grant anyway, is get your employers involved on the advisory committee. And we've always emphasized the more you can get them to bond you to the program, you're going to find they're going to be your best friend in hiring your students, because we find that when employers work with the students and attend it, and I think one of the better grantees in my neighborhood is Durham, that has an employer group, and they hold meetings. And as a matter of fact, when they invite you to a meeting, the invites come from the employers. They found it very valuable, and one of them actually did a study that he saved about $7,000 by hiring students from the program. And so they've got a little group of employers. And these employers know each other. They're good friends, so they're kind of friendly competitors. But they form this group, and what's really neat is when you get a group like this and you get them to teach classes or do an awareness night or talk about their program, ask them to speak to your class or talk to your class about what they do. And the more they get involved, and some of these employers donate facilities or in-kind time, and they'll often do that, speak in front of your class or help you. In some cases, they provided equipment. We had one case 1 year where they were providing not only equipment but a facility for fit-up. So it's really important to get your employers involved. Those same employers that could act as your references there's a good chance that they'll hire your students. And as Kathleen said on the last call, you don't want to just have one employer. If something were to happen to him or his business slows down, you don't want to say, well, I really like this program, we're not hiring. You need to expand your program as best you can. But it's kind of like a double whammy. If you engage them, get them involved in your program, get them to leverage, to provide you. And again, it's a little counterintuitive. The more they help you, the more they're going to help you. If they're giving you equipment or facilities or some instructional time, they're going to get to know your students on a one-on-one. And once they get to know the students, they may say, I really like this guy. He's going to fit into my organization. So when it's time, come and talk to us on a serious level. Other grantees have used internships, which is similar to what I just said. They'll actually do internships with some of the employers. And, of course, internships are great because, again, it gives FaceTime, one-on-one. And these employers really, they could look on paper and look at credentials. But like any interview for a job, the more time you spend with the student, the better the experience will be and more likely he's going to hire you. So, again, you want to go one-on-one as kind of the first step. To the extent that you could write these into your plan, it's great. You know, that whole process of evaluation on these grants, you've got about 25% of your time or your scores involved with partnerships, community involvement, and employers. And all of those are slightly different but similar. And it involves interaction with the community, with the employers, and with partnerships. And your employers are your partners, and they're also in your community. So it's all one. There are all the other standard things the job boards, the placement firms. We find that manpower firms are excellent sources. In our next cohort, we'll actually talk about different things like that different grantees are using in terms of the technical. But now, as you're developing your plan, you want to look at these types of strategies that you may use to engage your employers and to get them to use your students. I like Detroit. I don't know if they're on the line. Yes.
Mike.
Yes.
For retention, I would like to recommend that they look at retention as starting on day one. Hopefully within your program, you'll have a student advocate person that they can go to.
Right.
Because generally when economic situations are not the best, you have a domino effect. There is no child care, transportation. So that in order to retain the student in the class so you can get them to the point where they're being placed into a position, you need to think about retention seriously. And also use those very first weeks of the training to vet the person's viability for staying in the program for training long term. And that's where the student advocate can come in, where they can have a one-on-one with the student. Are you a single parent? Do you have support? What's your portrait?
Right.
The student's portrait. And you have to have those partners because, again, our funding is just $200,000. It does not go far. Those partners to address the various issues, such as no funds for child care, no child care, husband left, wife left me with the kids, car broke down, don't have money to repair it. Make sure you have partners there that you can reach out to that will be able to assist you in retaining. No one can learn all that they need to learn to become a specialist if they're wrapped up into personal
right.
issues.
Well, and you know, we could talk about all the institutional things you can do, but when it comes down to it, that, as I said, getting together and friendships, someone can't get to class, hey, their buddy could go pick them up. Someone needs a daycare, a babysitter, well, someone else has one, and maybe they could team up. So there's just so much you can do when you get personal and you do the team building. So, again, it's part of that recruitment process. Is your class going to be cohesive and work together, or are they all just going to come to class and go home? It is a problem with your dispersed communities where people live 50 miles away or they're coming in from a distance. It's a lot easier in smaller, tight-knit communities where everyone could socialize outside of the classroom, or they're within community difference of each other where they can help each other. And that, we've got some grantees where those classes are so tight-knit, they're buddies, and they become friends, and they help each other get jobs. They end up moving over to the other person's firm. It can't be understated enough, the importance of that, of team building in terms of that retention. One of the things I wanted to talk about is this, and I talked about it earlier, the importance of getting involved in the city. The city of Detroit was one of these, just as a real eye-opener, where the city was writing the grant with the WIB, and the project officer invited herself to a city meeting. And it was a meeting serendipitous with the developers, and it was actually a city office it was a financial office, and they were meeting. There was a lot of remediation going on in Detroit. The rebuild was Detroit. And they asked, could I sit in on this meeting? And, you know, you could come on, it's a public meeting, you could sit in. And she's sitting in on the meeting, and all the contractors are there, and they're complaining about, well, there's not enough people. We need qualified people to have these certifications. She raised her hand, I've got them. We're developing a training program. The next thing is, we'll hire everyone you can train. Can you produce more classes, because we're going to need them, and this is when we're going to need them, and we want your students, particularly the ones that are certified and ready and vetted, ready to go. So it's that importance of reaching out. And one of the last things we wanted to talk about today, and I'm sorry it's been so disruptive, is things you should be doing now. And when you look at that RFP, there's a certain number of those things you could do in your office, but there's a certain number, and it's about that 30% I was talking about that's going to require outreach. And when you talk about outreach, you're talking about time, and you're talking about meetings where you've got to get people together, you've got to get them in the room, you've got to go out, and you've got to talk to them and ask them if they'll be on your advisory committee, if they could come to a meeting where you're talking about developing your program plan. You really want to get them involved in writing the grant if you can. And, of course, everything we've talked about, to the extent that you could incorporate these things we've talked about in your grant, it's going to really help you out. Because if it's not written in the grant, they don't know you're doing it. So to the extent that you have a public meeting, it's got to be in that grant that you're writing. If you've got your advisory board, it's got to be in that grant. If you've got your instructors who have not only committed to looking at your students, but that they're interested in teaching a class, it's got to be written in that grant, because if it isn't, it doesn't exist as far as the evaluators go. But this outreach you've got to do now, because we're up at Christmas, and the timing of this is always not good for the grant writers, because there's save the things over the holiday that you could do in grant writing, but before, we've got a week before Christmas, and then about a week after Christmas, and people go on vacation, so you may not be able to even make an announcement at a city council meeting. If you can, go to the city council meeting and ask for 5 minutes of your intentions to submit a grant to EPA for developing a job training program. One of the kickbacks on this is that people are afraid to do this because they don't want to commit that we're doing this and you don't get the grant. Well, the magic words here is we're planning on submitting a grant. We're putting our team together. If we don't get it this year, we're going to reapply next year. You're not saying we've got the grant, but you're asking for their help and you want to submit a grant. And there's nothing wrong with not getting it. And you're not, it takes a little bit of self-assurance to go out there and to tell people, whether it's in the mayor's office or in city council, or if it's an employer, that you're going to do this. And we've had some grantees we worked with that said, I committed to the brownfields, I committed to the city hall, I committed to the employers, they're all on board and I didn't get the grant and I missed it by 0.2 of a point, or I missed it by 2 points. And they were really bummed out, really bummed out. And I don't blame them. But the response to that is, next year is another year. And it's not the worst thing in the world. It says, there are only 17 people that got it. We just missed it by a hair, and we're going to work on it to go back, and we're going to get it next year. Can you stay on board with this? So it's one of these things that it's not – most people get the grant, and then they get the commitments. Here you have to get the commitments and develop the partnerships before you can get the grant. And the more of these you can get and document, the way up on the list you're going to go. And again, those things are going to take some time. And we don't have a lot of time now. So when we wind this call up and we say, what should we be doing now, between now and, say, our next PLC call on the 6th, we should be going out in the community and not committing yourself, but announcing your intentions to do this and asking people if they would be on board. If you get the grant, will you help us do these things? And then, of course, get the names, get the documentation, make sure as you're writing this grant, when over Christmas and when you can't get a hold of anyone, make sure you document all these things you're doing in the outreach. So now's the time to be, it's too late if you haven't done it. I mean, you should have done it last year, but given the point you haven't done it yet, do it now so you can get it written into that grant that you've actually done it. And I think that'll help you immensely as we go on. Anybody have any questions or contributions? Okay. We will put in the post-session notes all sorts of things about making sure you contact your faith-based organizations, holding your public meetings, talking to your potential employers, your key partners, and making sure certainly you get into City Hall. So if nothing else, I hope if we clarified this whole issue of setting up your curriculum and how you can do that. And if you have any questions, just email us about that, and we'll try to get back with you with answers. Anything else from anybody? No? Okay. Well, if not, I apologize for our communications, poor communications today, but we'll send you post-session notes, and we'll see you all on the 6th of January. Well, good luck with your proposals.